In Sweden, like here in America, they have these things called co-working spaces where different small businesses all kind of merge their assets so they can share Xerox machines and computers and all the rest of it. Well, at one of these places in Sweden, 15, maybe 20% of employees there volunteered, get this, to have a chip embedded in their skin simply to replace an electronic entry card for getting in the building, around the building. Of course, most workplace wearables aren't that invasive. More commonly, they're wristbands or badges. Some cool examples. Truck drivers at Rio Tinto's coal mines use a smart cap. It kind of looks like a baseball cap, but it has sensors in it to detect when a driver is approaching what they call a microsleep, you know, when your head starts to nod. There's a wearable camera that takes video of complex construction problems where the people on site are confused as heck at what to do, but it can be viewed in real time by an expert. It could be 1,000 miles away. The pickers at Amazon Warehouse, the people who take the stuff to get it in the boxes to get to our house, they wear GPS tags and have a handheld scanner that tells them the most efficient route in this huge warehouse to collect the item. People at meetings, instead of checking email with their clunky smartphones and tablets, they glance now at a smartwatch that connects them to coworkers for time-sensitive messages. Workplace wearables are even used to enhance worker health, like to qualify workers for workplace rewards for walking, say, those 10,000 steps that we're supposed to take. Of course, there are questions about workplace wearables, for example, privacy. And are workplace wearables an unfair tool for making already overworked workers do even more, faster, cheaper, now? With me to address the present, the promise, and the perils of workplace wearables is Brent Bloom. He is head of the wearable technology practice at Accenture. Brent, welcome to Work with Marty Nemco.
Yeah, hey, Marty.
So, I want to start with something evil. A listener to this show heard that I'd be doing this segment this week, and she left me a voicemail that said something like, "Wearables are another tool of hard-assed employers. They are a virtual whip for flogging workers to do ever more." How would you respond to that?
Well, I think if we take a step back, wearables are good at two things. They're good at enabling hands-free work, and then they're also really great at collecting advanced levels of biometric data, things like heart rate and stress levels and so forth. And so, you know, the former is a little bit less controversial. Most people would agree that being able to do your job and have your hands free to hold tools and receive instructions is really valuable.
Give me an example of one of those.
All right, well, let's think of an employee wearing smart glasses and they're trying to repair a pump. Maybe it's a junior engineer and he's seen this done once or twice, but it's his first time out in the field. And so because the smart glasses have a camera on them, a remote supervisor could see exactly what they're seeing in real time. And when that employee is ready, they say, "Well, I need a little bit of help. I'm on step four. I'm not quite sure what to do next." And then that remote expert could see what they're seeing in real time and tell them, "Oh, hey, you need to cut the red wire, not the black wire."
Or even more simply, let's say, you know, so much of us get our self-help advice from YouTube videos.
Yeah.
So if somebody is trying to repair something very simple, like replace a light socket or whatever, they can simply, you know, Google, using like a Google Glass or whatever, and Google replace a light socket and, have a video of it right in front of you at the time. Is that fair?
Exactly. And you're holding the light bulb and all the other tools you'd need in that moment.
Okay, so that's not so controversial, but you say that biometrics can be used we think of them as for commercial entry into buildings, we think of them for security in general, you know, anti-terrorism, whatever, but
yep.
They're also used in medical applications, you know, your blood pressure, heart rate gets immediately wirelessly sent to your doctor in case things are bad. Tell us more about, you say that that's more controversial. What makes biometrics more controversial?
I think it's a brand new space for people. It's a very personal form of data and information. And as a society, we're still working through, you know, what's collected, when is it collected, when is it appropriate, how is it protected, and so forth. And so you mentioned the wellness challenges that companies have. Today, those are very benign. And no one would say that 10,000 steps is something that's too personal. But Some of these devices also collect sleep information. And what if that becomes part of the wellness challenge? And then your boss sees that you're not sleeping well, and that can't be good or positive. So it's important to draw boundaries around what's collected and how it's used.
Yeah, I could see in the extreme. Now, we don't want to be guilty of exaggerated catastrophizing, but yes, you could see like an automatic breathalyzer, seeing if you have, toxic or imbibable, hallucinogens in your system, yeah. Pot or whatever.
Yeah.
You could see if somebody's, maybe in... they want to test their blood pressure. Is there, do we want to take the risk of having higher health costs by having this person with high blood pressure in our workforce? So there are certainly issues that need to be great. Like everything else, it's a matter of moderation and moderate regulation. Is that a fair statement?
I would say so. Those are important questions to work through. For me, it's about how does the data support the job function? So, if finding out someone's stress level or fatigue level is related to a hazardous job they perform, then it's very relevant. Let's take an example from the airline industry. Today pilots are grounded if they haven't had X hours of rest. But what if I need 10 hours of sleep and you need 6? Mm. So today there are wearables that detect fatigue and focus and concentration, and those could be valuable. If I'm a passenger on that plane, I'm all for the pilot who's better rested.
I'm interested. I want to take the gray area. That's pretty clear.
Yeah.
So let's say I am a middle manager in a mid-sized nonprofit, and we get to the point, it won't be forever, that they can measure your cortisol levels. Cortisol levels are a degree of anger, essentially. Anger, stress and anger hormones that get released. On some level, on the positive side, one could argue that that could prevent workplace violence.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody whose cortisol levels are now going through the roof, and yeah. So that's it. Bring in the psychologist to talk to the guy or woman before he explodes. It could be used to simply managers that tend to just lose their temper. We all who have a proclivity to anger regret having lost our temper in a meeting, and so. Providing that cortisol, not just to the bosses, but to the manager themselves, a little vibrator on their smart wrist
mm-hmm.
that says, "Hey, your cortisol level's through the roof, dear. You're at risk of blowing it."
Yeah.
So those are the positive sides, but I can see all kinds of negatives. In that, for a human being to be under such a microscope, or already under such stress, that it would make the stress incredible. Even more so. And, of course, stolen private data that's used not just to improve, quality of work in the workplace, but could be used for blackmail. It can be used, we see how much hacking. The NSA has been hacked. The Federal Employee Website has been hacked. Major companies like Target have been hacked. This data could be used as blackmail and by nefarious signs. And then there's the issue of of false positives.
Yep.
Very little data is so foolproof. So what are your thoughts about any of that melange?
Yeah, I think we have to walk before we run. And in instances like that, at least by today's standards of privacy and employee rights and so forth, I think a program like that would have to be something you opt into. With wearables in general, they need to be tools that help employees do their job better, that are the request of the employee. Because at least in my career, technology that's pushed upon people tends to find its way into the garbage can. It gets lost, it gets broken, and it's all very mysterious.
Sure.
And so the wearable in your example would need to be something that an employee opted into, that they wanted to manage a situation they were having. And my guess is that employee already knows they have an issue with anger, or the people around him know that. And so it might... We might only be quantifying the problem. There might not even be wonderful revelations around it.
And in these days, though, that quantification is pretty important. It's very difficult to terminate an employee. And if we have this corroborating evidence that this person's, cortisol level frequently goes to the 99.9 percentile, and then, that could be, say, at least it's if not for termination, say, hey, we're going to have to put you on an, quote, improvement plan. Look at all of this and look at your subsequent behavior. Before we leave all of this, these issues, I want you to address specifically the issue that listener has talked about. She called very provocatively. She called these, quote, productivity tools a virtual whip.
Yeah.
What would you say to that woman, to that person?
I think that there is that possibility, but that's not where the most successful wearables implementations that I've been a part of have started, right? It's about that junior engineer who's in the field and needs help doing their job, someone who wants to reference a manual and understand the schematic on page 47 and keep their hands free to hold their tools.
Okay, let's talk about other examples. You're working for Accenture. Companies pay you, you know, they bill you out at $700 an hour or whatever, you know. So what do they bill you out at $700 an hour to do? What kind of wearables, what kind of stuff are you touting for businesses to use as workplace wearables?
Yeah, we help the Fortune 500 define how to use wearable technology. And so in industries like oil and gas, aerospace and defense, manufacturing, you've got a lot of employees who use their hands to do their job. Many of them wear safety gloves. Maybe there's one computer in the shop and it's all the way across the floor. And so understanding we help companies understand how to implement these devices such that the privacy concerns are met, such that employees are happy, such that the data is secure, and the programs are successful. You know, you can't just throw any application or any document on a smartwatch or pair of smart glasses and hope that it sticks, right? You have to reformat it to that new form factor and make sure that the system's easy to use. So from start to finish, that is my job, is ensuring that these projects go off well and that the end result is a more productive employee.
You're talking about the hands-free stuff. I'm looking to, so now let's move to something slightly cooler.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that is, you know, it doesn't take a genius to picture an Apple Watch that is customized with various apps specific to that workplace. Are we there yet? Or, you know, what's realistic that's currently available in terms of that would have a higher coolness factor than, say, even Google Glasses or things like that?
In so many ways, the technology is ready. It's ready to add value. I think there's still a realization that these things take time to work into major companies who have complex IT systems. And so smartwatches are certainly ready today. They're ready to it might be cool to me. I don't know about cool to the average consumer, but Fortune 500 companies have invested millions and billions of dollars in their existing data systems, things like SAP and PeopleSoft. And now we can get that information on a smartwatch or on smart glasses. Mm-hmm. And for you and I, when mobile phones came out, that really changed our world personally and professionally. But for an employee who uses their hands to do their job, you know, it's not until wearables have come along that we can really take that legacy data and put it in the middle of their job to help them.
That's simply the next stage in the miniaturization thing. I mean, we are all, you know, in theory, all we really needed was a big clunky desktop computer, and yet we crave portability.
Sure.
That's how mobile phones, as you said, came into existence. And the more you can get onto your watch where you don't have to pull out, you know, an iPad today is feeling very clunky. It's feeling like a big device.
Yeah.
You know, even your smartphone, you know, the Galaxy Notes are a little larger and people are resisting them because they just don't quite fit into your pocket very well.
Yeah.
So having it all on your watch with some kind of a voice interface, you don't need a keyboard of any sort, would seem to be irresistible if just from a simple user pleasure perspective. Is that a fair statement?
It is. And part of the work we do is to determine what steps in someone's job are appropriate to put on a watch or a pair of glasses, and which ones still require a tablet or a real computer.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Because you've got less screen real estate.
Hey, you know, I feel like going to the phones. Hey, if you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko with my guest Brent Bloom. He is the head of the practice in wearable technology at Accenture. If you've got a question or a comment for him about wearables in the workplace, positive, negative, or maybe you even have some experience with it already and what's going on, we invite you to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. So far, we've been talking about most of these wearables being focused on worker bees. You know, they're things to make the worker more productive. What about, are there any for the higher-ups?
You know, those examples are fewer and further between. You know, I can think of a supervisor who's got a smartwatch and gets pinged with, you know, status updates and the progress of his team. But for the most part, those kinds of knowledge workers are at desktop computers or have mobile phones.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, phone number again, if you have a question or a comment for Brent Moon about wearables in the workplace, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's your question or comment for Brent?
Hi, my name is Lisa, and I've heard, maybe this is an urban legend, you know, I always wear my cell phone in my back pocket, and I was told, don't do that because it can cause, like, uterine cancer or whatever. Okay, great, so I put it in my breast pocket. Oh, don't do that because it'll cause breast cancer. So I'm thinking, if I'm going to wear something of any type of electronic device, I know these are so young, there's been no studies or anything, but I'm thinking, are they safe? Am I going to end up with breast cancer 10 years from now?
Good question. Brent?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very real concern. But so far, these devices have proven to be safe. You know, the FCC regulates radio waves in all its forms, and things like smart glasses, even with the processor and the battery so close to one's head, are very closely scrutinized. So I think it's a realistic concern, but one that so far, as a society, we've got under control.
With regard to the phones, of course, I shared some of that concern. So when I was looking, I, as usual, Google's my expert. So I Googled the question of radiation and cell phones. And a couple of things. Yes, he's absolutely right that currently there is no data. They've been studying this now for decades. It's not like cell phones are new technology. They've been doing this for decades. More importantly, if for peace of mind, it really does come, if you are concerned about that, there's a very wide range in the amount of radio frequency that gets sent out by different phones. It can be as low as about 0.4 somethings to 1.45 something. So that's almost four times as much. So if you're nervous about that at all, you may want to see whether your phone is one of those that emits a particularly high amount of radiation, and as well, using a hands-free device, so you're not holding the device to your ear, is something you might want to do. But you may also want to keep it in your purse rather than in your pocket, if not for actual medical risk. The medical increased risk is probably very small. We take probably bigger risks being in the sun and being exposed to sunlight, which has radiation. So, but for peace of mind, which matters an awful lot, why not just keep your phone in your purse, you know, and not pressed against your body for any, at least not for long periods. Is that helpful at all? Well, she was so helpful she got off the phone. Anyway, let's speaking of health, you know, wearables had their origin in the 80s when Philips Technologies created devices that would monitor patients, elderly patients typically, who were homebound. They would monitor their heart rate, their blood pressure, and then back then it was a wired connection to their doctor. Now those devices exist and they're sent wirelessly instantly to a nurse or nurse practitioner to note anomalies and you know, the doctor can then call. What is the current state of the art with regard to medical wearables at this point?
Yeah, sure. There's a couple really interesting things going on. We work with many of the smart glasses we work with have augmented reality capabilities, meaning that you see the world around you, but then there is data superimposed on that real world that you're looking at. And so for nurses, one of the most exciting technologies is the ability to put on smart glasses and actually see the veins of a patient. The glasses have an infrared camera that then maps those veins. And so when you're getting your blood drawn or any of that, now they can see exactly where to put the needle.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. They always say he who lives by the crystal ball eats broken glass. But let's take a shot. I don't want you to project 20 years out. Nobody can do that. But if you were to look in the tea leaves, whatever, for a couple of years out, what's not currently available that you think is likely to come available in the next, you know, couple of years, 2, 3, 5 years, whatever, that we should hear about?
Yeah. On the wrist, we're already starting to detect heart rate and, what we today call a smartwatch. I think we'll look back and think, well, that was funny.
Heart rate's on everybody's, you know, Fitbit. You can measure heart rate and stuff like that. That's certainly available. I'm talking about a little bit
yep.
futurist.
And as that trend continues, We'll be able to do bioauthentication through the wrist. And there are currently wrist-worn devices that check the unique variability of your heart rate. Right. That'll consolidate down into a smartwatch. The evolution of that heart rate detection will then allow you to open doors, computers, cars, operate a forklift, and so on.
How is that better than biometrics, where you can
it
just
is biometrics?
Through, but I mean through your, I mean, I'm sorry, iris recognition. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have a unique configuration of our iris. Why does the smartwatch, why is it better than iris recognition?
I think there are levels of accuracy that are better in that particular approach. It's also something that, you know, maybe the forklift doesn't have an iris detector. It's just another way to authenticate yourself.
Yeah, maybe another, cheaper. Yeah.
Another exciting technology is EEG monitors. They're becoming smaller. They're getting built into hard hats and baseball caps and so forth. So the ability to detect someone's focus or concentration or stress gets really interesting. And back to our airline example, I think we'll start to see a world where work is given to the people who are most suited to do it. And training is issued for the tasks that cause stress or confusion.
That sounds like a long way away, but that brings us full circle back to the privacy issues. If you've mm-hmm. got some, you know, if your EEG waves, you know, how engaged are you every second there? How, at what point does it, whatever benefits to productivity in the workplace is outweighed by the fact that you're constantly being monitored? It's like people bristle against, for example, keystroke monitors. We can, anybody who's a, you know, got a key, a data entry person, mm-hmm. they count their damn keystrokes.
Yeah.
You know, and we've now come to accept that, but it feels like if even what your internal brain, how activated your brain is at a given moment. You know, let's say, heaven forbid, you want to take 5 minutes to rewatch the video of the Stanford, you know, Rose Bowl game.
Sure.
You know, it feels a little scary. Should I be scared or should I be reassured?
I think you should be reassured.
Why?
These are mostly hazardous professions that we're talking about, where no one on an offshore oil rig is watching a bowl game, right? It's very different than the kind of jobs that you and our friends have.
Thanks. We've got more calls, so let's take a couple of calls before I let you go. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, Brent Bloom from Accenture's Wearable Technology Practice. What is your question or comment for him? Hi, it's you. Hello? Are you there? Let's go to the next line. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Yes, I was wondering how I could get work in that area. I actually have a PhD in speech user interface design area.
Well, that's certainly an area we need a lot of help with, especially as speakers of a variety of different languages and specific medical fields and legal fields and so forth start to find uses for wearables. So I think I might not have more specific actionable advice than that, but that is a growing area of demand.
I'll just apply my standard career counseling advice to your situation. What I would do if I were you is I would write a white paper, a 3-5 page white paper on the applicability of your voice technology expertise to various wearables in the workplace space, whether it be for safety reasons, productivity reasons, health enhancement reasons, whatever. That would not just be ideas off the top of your head, that would probably integrate, you know, do some research, some Google research or whatever, on finding out best practices in the current use of that, then add your own spin on what you do and what you think, and use that as proof of concept that you're knowledgeable in the space. Then I would identify the leading companies in those workplace wearable spaces. What are some of those, by the way? What are a few of the companies that are in those? Do you know?
Sure. Companies like Apex Labs, Daiquiri.
Daiquiri is in the drink?
Spelled differently, but yes.
spell it for him.
Daiquiri.
Okay. What else?
Daiquiri.
Hard glasses manufacturers like Recon, Epson, of course, Google. There's a company in the Bay Area, Kopin, that does some interesting
spell
stuff.
Spelled how?
Kopin.
So what I would do is I'd make a list of a bunch of those. And then I would send a letter explaining why you'd be well qualified, use the white paper as proof of concept, and then follow up with a phone call if they blow you off, which they usually do, and that'll show some persistence. What do you think about that?
I'm not quite sure where to send this. That's always the thing.
I wouldn't send it to human resources. I'd find somebody, you know, it sounds like you're, this is an, I'd find somebody who's the head of R&D, head of, go ahead.
Product, head of product.
Good. Yeah, so VP of product, director of product, something like that.
And to get, if they're not publishing, it's hard to get hold of their contact
information. Not as hard as you might think. If you take the name of the company and you Google the word product development or vice president, or you go to LinkedIn and you search on the name of the company, there often are people who are there with their at least title. Then you take their title and then you Google their name and the name of the company and the word email, and more often than you might realize, you might find it. And or you simply call the general number and say you're looking to speak, I want to speak with Joe Jones, please, and you get voicemail that can at least then ask for the email. So there's usually, you can't get through at 100%, success rate. You don't need it. You need one job. So you those are the kind of ways you can get through.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Let's take another one. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. Brent Bloom, the head of Accenture's wearable technology practice. What's your question or comment for him?
One of the good things about having things on a desktop is one has a polite excuse when one doesn't want to answer or be disturbed. So even an efficient worker doesn't want to keep being interrupted by contacts to answer a question. And with a wearable, you're always right there. So there's this expectation of instancy or instant response. I can't tell you how many people ask inane follow-up questions or want status updates when they don't really need them,
Brent,
and it really interferes even with a very productive, efficient worker. It's that whole team player thing, being the enemy rather than the friend. So having a desktop computer, just like saying, oh, I was on the other phone line, gives a polite way of saying, oh, gee, sorry, I couldn't answer you, I wasn't near my desk, or I was away from my desk, and people are kind of trained to sort of expect that or not expect an instant answer. With a wearable, you're stuck. It's with you all the time. Why didn't you answer me?
Caller, well, how is it different from, we already have your phone that's with you, or your laptop? How is the wearable really that, the old days it was beepers. How is this really any different? How is a watch different than having, your phone that's available?
Well, I think it tightens the noose that much further, and even when I say excuse making, it's very polite excuse making in the way of, here's Marty pinging me again to ask me that if he wants an update again. It's like there's nothing I can do about it. It's irritating. It's breaking my rhythm in getting things done.
Brent, what's
it? I just have a better excuse, and it's just, I understand for certain productive industrial workers it makes sense, but it's that much more of, it takes away from sort of a slippery zenness of doing a job. There's a way to do it, and a lot of times these technologies are really interruptions when what we need is concentration.
And that's where it's my job to design a system where the distractions are minimal. And the whole point of wearables and distraction is a very real one, especially in hazardous environments. We need to make sure workers are focused. And so one of the things we do is we create two levels of notifications, ones that are true emergencies, things like there's a gas leak, everyone evacuate, and others that are more informational, such as you've been assigned a new task. And if someone is in the middle of a task, we mute those more casual, less important notifications. We can also mute them based on if they're moving at a certain rate of speed, if they enter a certain part of the building. And all those are, of course, unique to the industry and the company we're working with.
Thank you very much for the call. Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Brett Bloom, the head of Accenture's wearable technology practice. What's your question or comment for him?
Yes, thank you very much. Marty, I very much appreciate your ability and interest always in seeing two sides
I try.
Of an issue. And that just came up, and I think it got slipped over a little bit. You were discussing with the guest this electroencephalogram thing, where people would be able to monitor whether you were concentrating on your work to a sufficient extent. You remember that?
Of course.
Exchange. And you pointed out, well, gee whiz, is that really so good from the individual's point of view? Imagine that if you think about something else for a few seconds, that it's going to go bad on your record. And the guest said, well, this is only for oil rig workers and people where if you do lose attention, something bad might happen. But then it got discussed, a different thing came up. But It strikes me that the fact that it's only being used now oil workers, perhaps for airplane pilots, things where critical decisions have to be made very quickly, doesn't mean that that's what will be a month from now or 2 months from now. And can we have any kind of assurances that the concerns that you expressed will be recognized when someone wants to sell something?
Brent, good question.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's up to responsible companies to treat their employees fairly and not implement policies that involve brainwave scanning where it's completely unnecessary or unrelated to the job.
Well, let's say that's an issue. I'm going to try to take a tougher stance. You know, you're right. What's going to your apps caller, your, as you know, your regular caller, obviously, you're absolutely right. The most likely scenario is going to be that they're going to monitor people's activation levels, and when people are at the below the 90th, below the 10th percentile, you know, in any job, from clerk to CEO to manager, whatever, they're going to call that person and say, you know, your activation level is very low. You look like you're half asleep a lot of the time. That has some advantages, but it also, you know, is everything is gray area, and that's why in my I'm just constitutionally a moderate. That's the reason for moderate government regulation, not too extreme, but there will need, as with all technologies, some measure of regulation to avoid the extremes. Brent, you wanted to say something else.
Simply that I don't, in Marty's example, the bottom 10%, I have a feeling that the supervisor of that individual and the coworkers of that individual probably already know they're in the bottom 10%. So it'll be something that's used to quantify in the worst cases.
Again, caller, I very much appreciate your call. Please keep calling.
Well, thank you very much.
Very good. Take care. All right. Well, we're out of time, so I just want to give you one softball last question. You know, you're going to go home and you're going to think about, you know, this interview.
Sure.
Is there one thing that you either, that you haven't said so far that you would have said, damn it, I wish I said that?
Just in talking about some things that are really exciting with wearables, and we're working with an aerospace and defense company right now, and they have this fuselage for the plane itself, and there's a wiring harness that needs to route the wires from one part of the plane to another, and we've built a system that uses augmented reality to show that operator how to route the wiring harness. And not only is it like super cool just to experience, but it's wildly efficient to see, to look out on this fuselage and see exactly where to route the wiring harness. And you know, that's the tip of the iceberg. We're just getting started with applications like this. So that's what I think to be the positive spin of wearable technology.
Well, I'm glad that you've brought our, enlightened our listeners as to, you know, it really is something that's, you know, for better or for worse, is certainly going to becoming a bigger and bigger part of our workplace wearables. So, Brent Bloom, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. I should like give you an opportunity for a little pitch. What if somebody's listening to this show who works for a company and is intrigued by all of this kind of stuff, how can you help them, and how should they contact you?
Yeah, certainly. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. Feel free to reach out to me, and I'm happy to help help design a wearables program for your company.
But by the way, his name, he wants his name pronounced Bloom, but it's spelled Blum. It's B-L-U-M. So make sure you get that right. Just, you know, do Brent Bloom Accenture, and you'll find them. Just Google that, and you'll find them.
Thanks, Marty.
It's my pleasure indeed. Okay, now we turn to you. As you know, as usual, in the first part of the show, I like to talk about the big issues that affect us broadly. In the second part of the show, I care about you as a human being, as an individual. So if you or someone you love is stuck, you don't have a job, you are unhappy in your current job, you're self-employed and are struggling, you are looking for a kinder Shark Tank, you know, where you've got an idea and you want to run it by me, I will ask the hard questions. No, I won't invest probably, but you never know. All those are good reasons to call. I call them workovers. Whatever your career conundrum, I can usually help. The price is certainly right. Zero, zippo, nada. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and KLW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I was promised I would do this. The librarians at the San Francisco Public Library are kind enough to keep wanting me to come back to do various workshops for them and for free, which I'm happy to do as part of my pro bono work. I'm doing one this Saturday. It is... I got the wrong flyer out here. I'm doing two, but that's the one. Okay, yeah. This Saturday from 10 to 12 at the main branch of the library... I'm trying to put myself out of business. I'm a career coach, and I'm going to be teaching something called co-coaching. how you and a friend, a respected friend, can coach each other to mutual benefit and not have to spend money on a career counselor. So that's from 10 to 12 on this Saturday at the main branch of the library in the, what they call it, the Latino-Hispanic Community Room. Don't worry, you don't have to speak Spanish. I'll speak English, I promise. So that's what I got this at. And so we got calls on the line. So we'll get the phone number again. If you have a work-related problem, 415-841-4134. That's the number for work over here at KALW and work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello? Are you there? Nope, gone. I always like on the show, while I'm waiting for calls to come in, to share problem, describe a problem, but I never offer a problem without a solution. So I was really kind of, I guess the word is dispirited, when I read something from the Pew Research Center that said the middle class is now a minority. A study based on analysis of government data and used a common definition of middle-income Americans as those with annual income from 46 to 126 grand. That's kind of middle class. Under this definition, the middle class is now only half of the U.S. population, down from 61% in 1971. So when we hear about the hollowing out of the middle class, the evisceration of the middle class, for those who are a little more graphic, it really is true. More statistics that got me started on a search for statistics, and I came up with this, found this article called 50 Facts About the U.S. Economy from 2015 That Are Almost Too Crazy to Believe. And as usual, I promise I will get to solutions later, but I want to lay out the issue. The mainstream media, and actually he wrote this, the guy's Michael Snyder at Zero Hedge. Zero Hedge is a financial analysis website that has grown to become the 990th most visited website on the entire web, and you've probably never even heard of it. It's read by all the kind of the financial prediction gurus at the Goldman Sachs's and the big banks. And so here's what he's written. This just came out like last week. He writes, "Don't be fooled by all the happy talk coming from the mainstream media. When you look at the cold, hard numbers, they tell a completely different story. The following are 58 facts about the U.S. economy from 2015 that are almost too crazy to be. Don't worry, I won't read all 58, but I got about two dozen of them that really blew me away, and maybe you'll find at least mildly interesting. According to a Georgetown University study, and by the way, anybody who wants to, I have links to all of these. You know, the article included links to the primary sources, so you're always welcome. I try really hard never to cite statistics without good substantiation. I don't pick wild websites. They're usually very substantiated. So if you're interested in substantiation, just email me. I respond to all my email. My email address is mnemko@comcast.net. That's mnemko@comcast.net. So, okay, now back to these statistics. According to a Georgetown University study, there are 900,000 fewer middle-class jobs in America than there were when the last recession began, even though our population has grown significantly larger at that time. Next statistic. This was number 9. According to the Social Security Administration, 51% of all American workers make less than $30,000 a year. Here's number 55. According to data released by the Associated Press, the total amount of student loan debt in the United States has risen to $1.2 trillion, more than doubled over the past decade. Here's number 56. Right now, there are 40 million Americans paying off student loan debt, 40 million. For many of them, they will keep making payments on this debt until they're senior citizens. According to the Fed, 48.8% of all 25-year-old Americans are still living at home with their parents. 48.8%. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are 7.9 million working-age Americans that are, quote, officially unemployed right now, and another 94.4 million working-age Americans that are considered to be, quote, not in the labor force. When you add those two numbers together, you get a grand total of 102.3 million working-age Americans that do not have a job right now. Here's number 39. The Fed reports that the labor force participation for men has plunged to the lowest level ever recorded. According to John Williams of ShadowStats.com, they produce statistics that are an attempt to provide a more full dimension look at the act the government provides statistics. According to John Williams with ShadowStats.com, if the U.S. government was actually using honest numbers, the unemployment rate in this nation would be 22.9%. And that doesn't count underemployment. That is people who used to make $100,000 a year who are now working for $12 an hour part-time. According to Federal Reserve statistics, back in 1950, more than 80% of all men in the United States had jobs. Today, only 65%. Another Pew study. That's kind of redundant. I'm going to leave it out. I'm going to leave that out, too. Okay. A recent nationwide survey found that 48% of all U.S. adults under the age of 30 believe that, quote, the American dream is dead, end quote. Number 14, traditionally entrepreneurship has been one of the primary engines that's fueled the growth of the middle class in the U.S., but today, using federal statistics and the results of a Gallup poll, the level of entrepreneurship in this country is at an all-time low. Number 15, for each of the past 6 years, more businesses have closed in the U.S. than have opened. Prior to 2008, this has never happened in all of U.S. history. Number one, according to CBS MarketWatch today, 62% of all Americans have less than $1,000 in their savings account. Number three, according to Business Insider, 43% of all American households spend more money than they make each month. Number 12, since hitting a peak of 69.2% in 2004, the Fed reports that the rate of home ownership in the U.S. has been steadily declining every single year. According to a report in The Guardian, that well-known British publication, the top 0.1% of all American families have as much wealth as the bottom 90% of all American families combined. Talk about income inequality. According to data from the Social Security Administration, if you have no debt and you have $10 in your pocket, that gives you a greater net worth than 25% of all Americans. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 49% of all Americans now live in a home that receives money from the government each month. 49%, and nearly 47 million Americans are living in poverty right now. In 2007, about one of eight children in America was on food stamps. Today, that's gone to one in every five. One in every five kids are on food stamps. 2007, it was just one in every eight. According to Catherine Eden, the author of a new book called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America, there are 1.5 million, quote, ultra-poor households in the U.S. that live on less than $2 a day. The number has doubled since 1996. 46 million Americans use food banks each year. Police in New York City have identified 80 separate homeless encampments in the city alone. And the homeless crisis there has gotten so bad that it's being described as, quote, an epidemic. Holiday sales have gone negative for the first time since the last recession. According to the Dr. Housing Bubble website, there have been nearly 8 million homes lost to foreclosure since the home ownership rate peaked in 2004. And an astounding $8.16 trillion has already been added to the U.S. national debt since 2008, much of it to China. I must leave to the economist as to whether the right answer is more government programs or fewer, but certainly as 2016 begins, it is certainly going to be quite a year. I have proposed some solutions that I think are partial solutions in previous programs. I've talked about the importance of having entrepreneurship education K through 16 that's simulation-based, not lecture. An assistance army where we encourage more people to hire people to help make their lives easier, everything from with child care to tutoring on technology to whatever. And all of us probably need to learn to eschew the materialistic-centric society and learn to live on less. But now I want to focus on you as an individual. So if you have a work-related problem, I want to solve your problem. We may not be able to solve society's problem, but we can usually help you find some better way for you. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello, it's you. We keep losing calls. This is like the third call out of four. So, okay. What I'm going to be doing... Oh, we've got other calls, so let's go back to the phones. Let's try it again. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, I had a question.
Good.
For your guest.
No, for the... Oh, my guest.
But maybe you can answer it. I was wondering if there are any wearable apps that could help a worker concentrate better or focus better.
Well, I don't know if there are any apps, but, you know, maybe this is because I love coffee so much. It works differently for everybody. But there have been many studies. This is not just anecdotal. But I am typical of a large number of people who find that caffeine increases attention and IQ, and also it has all kinds of other general health benefits, unless you have high blood pressure or something else. But also, sometimes you're not being able to pay attention is a symptom of other things rather than a wearable. I will ask you two questions. Most basically, and it's kind of a duh, no-brainer, are you getting the 6 to 8 hours of sleep at minimum that you need to get on a daily basis or not?
That's typically an issue for me.
Okay. That's critical. And if you're having trouble with that, do you have a good sleep ritual? Do you make the room cool at night because we sleep better when it's cool? Do you have the same restful ritual before you go to bed? Listen to some soft music on your MP3 player, a clock radio that's near your web. You know, do you clear all your thoughts by having a mantra that you say to yourself? Do you have a nice little sleep ritual or not really?
Well, that is something I should work on. I do kind of break all the rules. I know there's something. I think they call it sleep hygiene. And
right.
One of the things you're not supposed to do is to look at like computers or tablets or stuff right before you go to bed.
Correct. You're more activated. We heard about EEGs. Your EEG is more activated when you're doing that. You want to slow down. You know, there's a mantra I use for myself, which is, Martin, you put in a good work day, now you're entitled to peace. And I absolutely, once I'm done, and I work until late at night, but for like the last half hour or so, I have this leisurely sleep ritual, and I get in the bed, I hug my doggie or my wife or both, and, you know, put on my little CD, MP3 player, so I would encourage you you're entitled to sleep. You can't, no human, even if you have the most fascinating job in the world, you can't focus on it if you're sleep deprived, dude. So you owe it to yourself as well as to your workplace. And then the other thing, of course, is your job soul deadening? I mean, somebody who's a data entry clerk at some point, or who's a night watchman, or who's got just tedious work that feels ultimately soulless and empty, is also going to get either bored or feel, you know, the sense of enemy, of alienation. Is your work reasonably worthy of staying awake for?
I think at this point it is, yeah. There are times it gets tedious and I really need to focus. And I think when I feel fatigued, and that's very hard.
Exactly. The other thing is, are you distractible? Does your desk face out where there's all kinds of stimulation, attractive people walking by, good noise, whatever? Could you have a desk that faces a wall that's a little quieter, if not a private office? Are you having too much? Or create a little cardboard carrel, you know, like in the libraries. They used to have these carrels where it's like blinder, like on a horse in a race. They put these things called blinkers on them so they can't look to the sides. Do you need a carrel on two pieces of cardboard on your desk to keep you focused? Any of that have a resonance of validity?
I'm pretty walled off. So there's not a lot of distractions where I work.
Dude, then please give yourself permission to get some sleep. Every night you deserve, everybody deserves that. Is there any reason you can't do that? Or, I mean, if you've got a screaming baby, that's going to be a problem. If you have some inordinate stress in your life that you have to address, you need to address the stress before you can let yourself wind down. Do you have some inordinate source of stress, sickness or family problems or screaming babies, or is it really more of a sleep hygiene issue?
I think it's more of a sleep hygiene issue. I just need to be disciplined. I think if I'm going to be looking at my tablet, I should at least do it in a different room, not in, in the room I'm trying to sleep
Give
in.
Give yourself a buffer, dude. You know, the half hour before you go to bed, your sleep is too important. Put the damn tablet away for 30 minutes. I'm not asking you to be a lazy person. You can work as long as you want, but the last 30 minutes, call it holy time. If you need to love yourself enough, because, by the way, being sleep deprived not only makes you unfocused, it makes you sick. It shortens your lifespan. So, dude, you got to love yourself enough to say that you can work as long as you want, but the last 30 minutes, that is holy time. That is time for you. All right?
Okay. All right.
Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Namco. Let's go back to the phone. Now we got a lot of lines lighted up. Phone number, I'm not going to give up the phone. We don't have time for any new callers, so we'll just try to get as many of the callers who are already on the line. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Beautifully.
Okay, great. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
A pleasure.
My name is Patrick. So I'm in the middle of like a career switch right now. I do visual design, but I want to switch into UX, and I'm trying to figure out a good way to do that.
Portfolio.
Yeah.
What you would want to do, especially since you've got the design background, what you'll want to do is create. You think about the kind of companies. You know, a big company is not going to hire. They don't hire career changers. If I'm a well-known company, an Apple or Google or Amazon, I'm not going to hire a career changer. So you're going to have to start at some smaller company. So identify some small companies that have a website or a product or that has an interface that you think would stand a lot of improvement. And then you create some, you know, a mock-up of the home screen that shows how well navigated it is, how clear the terms are describing each of the buttons, that is also visually interesting. Just only three. Create three of those home pages. Use that as a sample of your work, and that's what I would do. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call, Patrick. I wish you the best of luck. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Namco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Is it me?
It is.
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Oh, okay. I can't tell because I was listening at the same time. Hi. I am a caller who called in probably a few months ago. I was a school teacher and had kind of been chewed up and spit out by the public education system.
There have been a number of those callers who have called into the show. Absolutely.
I'm the one you told to make a video. Doing a cooking lesson, and you asked me to call back and tell you about my progress.
Right. You were going to try to transition into becoming some kind of a media chef. I think it may have been about vegan or healthy food or simple food or something like that.
Exactly.
So what happened?
So I've been thinking about you, and every week I'm like, I need to call him. I haven't shot the video lesson yet because I haven't, you know, the production people want like $400 or $500 just for one day.
I'm going to give you a tip right there. Let me interrupt you. Here's the tip. There is a videographer under every rock here in the Bay Area. What I would do if I were you is I would be going to, there's a million of these art schools that charge a fortune, and there's all these kids who have, you know, want to take video. Ask the instructor for a recommendation for one of his or her students that would do it for you and probably would do that for you for free in exchange for a credit on the video.
Yeah, that's what I want to do. And actually, since I spoke to you, I've actually launched my own chef business.
Chef business as in personal chef, going to people's houses and making them their vegan, local, sustainable, healthy, organic food.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like launching a full scale. So this is the thing. Maybe you can help me with. I'm having a hard time focusing because I'm actually teaching cooking classes. I'm listed with Cozy Meal and Vera Local, and they both bring me clients, but it's not really enough yet to make money off of. I am listed, I'm thinking about opening a food truck, and
I'm going to get you to focus. Yeah, food trucks too expensive. They cost $100,000. That was my idea of 2010, and then got big. Now there's a food truck. There's too many, so don't do that. Too expensive, too crowded market. What you need to do is this is marketing 101. The best source of new clients is your old clients. You say you've gotten a few referrals. What you really want to do is, with every satisfied client, get in the habit of saying, as soon as they compliment you on how wonderful the food is, then say, I really appreciate that. I love the work that I do. Might you know somebody else who I should call? Or they might call on your behalf. Or that you'd really welcome referrals. The best source of new clients is old clients. And you might For each of your clients, you might build a mailing list. And for example, send them a recipe of the week that is absolutely salivating, and that will remind them about you. And of course, most people who are going to hire a chef are not going to want to make the recipe themselves. They're going to hire somebody. They're going to hire you. That's why restaurants often publish their signature recipes, because they know most people aren't going to go through the hassle of doing it. So, what do you think about the idea of building your business? Pardon the pun, organically. by contacting your customers, both by phone, in person, and with an email newsletter.
I love it.
There you go. Well, thank you for giving me the progress report. Feel free to keep calling back. I'll keep giving you tips until you're fabulously wealthy and successful.
What is your email so I can email you once I get my video done?
Oh, that'll be fun. It's mnemko@comcast.net. That's mnemko@comcast.net.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Okay, we have time for one more call. Let's take one more. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi. I have just some feedback as to what's going on with your dropout calls. You can't tell when you're up. You can't tell you're listening. And
yeah,
you
this
can't
I understand.
Tell when you're coming up.
Yeah, I understand then, that. That's an anomaly. We're not going to be able to fix. But I appreciate that very much.
And the other thing is, you're quiet. You're not as quiet as you were before. The voice was really tiny on the other end, but now it's a little. That's originally why I was going to call.
Yeah, thank you.
That.
Yeah, I try to talk straight in the microphone, and I know my engineer is trying to monitor, keep the levels high enough, but it's hard to stay concentrating 100% of the time. So, but thank you very much for that.
It's not you speaking. It's the technical feedback. It's a technical line that goes back. But it's louder now than it was.
It could be because we've just moved to temporary quarters and we're still not. They've done a fabulous job in getting us as far as they have. But I'm hoping that the sound will be consistent moving forward. In fact, our wonderful engineer Phil Hartman is here, and I suspect he's hearing this. And I'm sure if it can be fixed, he will do it.
It doesn't seem to be as quiet on other call-in shows. I don't understand what it is about yours. Anyway.
It's probably my fault.
No. Something. I don't know. Okay, thank you.
I thank you. We are just about out of time, but I have just about a minute. So what I think I want to do is, I'm in the business of giving feedback to people. And we live in a society in which giving criticism is very hard to take. And I am, one of my resolutions for 2016 is I am just an intense person by nature, and nobody reacts well to intensity. So my final tip that I want to give to you for today is, when you have to give negative feedback, in general, your heart rate is going to go up. You're going to get nervous. Nobody likes to give negative feedback. That's the time to remind yourself that people are not going to react well to your suggestions. Even if the words are gently couched, I'm wondering if you might want to do it this way. If there is any kind of intensity or anger in your voice, you're going to be rejected. So my final tip of the day is, when you're having to give negative feedback, in addition to couching it in words that are respectful, like, I'm wondering if you might want to do it this way, having a tone of voice that suggests not too much intensity. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers, and I will talk with a true top recruiting expert, Jeff Hyman. He's going to show us how job seekers can prevail when there is very tough competition. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.